So as we think about the church in the second century, one of the fascinating issues about the church in the early years is growth. The way the church grew, the fact that it grew. We tend to treat this 2 millennia on as if the growth of the church was inevitable, as if, you know, God was behind it and therefore it would happen and therefore it is not of any particular interest what actually happened or why. But from the perspective of anyone standing at the beginning of the second century, the idea that Christianity would become the dominant faith of the empire within 2.5 centuries would have seemed kind of crazy. Christians at the beginning of the second century were a fringe group who were a minor fraction of the people in the empire. Most people in the empire did not know a Christian and did not know anything about Christianity at the beginning of the second century. Next slide. So let's spend a little time thinking about what happened that caused the church to grow in the way that it did. And to understand church growth. As a matter of fact, go to the next slide. This is the story of church growth in the Roman era, in the early years of the church. So from the year 50 or so to the year 350, this is more or less what happened. Now, this is not based on census data, but this is based on what do we know about what occurred over these years. And these numbers actually come from the sociologist Rodney Stark, who has studied this not as a historical item or as a study in evangelism. Stark has studied this as a sociological phenomenon. What is it that causes churches to grow? What is it that causes people to join churches? So when you look at this, this is based on growth at a rate of 40% per decade, which is a growth rate of 3.42% per year in the church. Now, over the first century, after Joseph Smith published the Book of Mormon, the Mormon church grew at a rate of 43% per decade. Okay? So 40% per decade is something that is supported by the growth of other religious groups across time. And sociologically, in the way that people behave, in the way that groups that succeed grow, this is basically what things look like. And this is basically what the other evidence suggests is what happened in the Roman era. Now, in the year 40, there were probably more than 1,000 Christians, based on what had happened at Pentecost, based on what had happened at the very beginning, there were probably 4,000 or 5,000 Christians. But in an empire that had 60 million people, 5,000 Christians is pretty much nobody, right? So, but by the year 100, maybe you got 10,000 Christians. Top end, maybe 12,000 in an empire of 60 million people. So, Virginia.
When Constantine became emperor, he legitimized Christianity. My question is, would the numbers from 40 to 300 reflect those alive after persecution or those who were alive and endured the persecution?
Yeah, so we're going to look a little bit at how did persecutions impact this? Okay, when does Constantine get converted to Christianity? 312. Okay. So 312, at a point where Christians were more than 10% of the people in the empire, but probably not yet 25% of the people in the empire. So at the time that Constantine is converted, Christians are a significant part of the people in the empire. They're far from a majority at that moment, but they are a large and significant part of the population of the empire at that moment. And the evidence strongly suggests that that Christians had made more inroads with the senior people in the Roman world than perhaps with any other group. When you look in the 4th century, the 300s, if you look at every piece of information we have about who was born and who was died, in the senatorial class in Rome, the upper crust of Roman society, about 50% of the men in the 4th century, in the 300s, are Christians. And about 85% of the women. Okay? And this is before Christians were half of the people in the empire. Okay? So Christianity spread among the Roman aristocracy faster than it spread almost anywhere else. Okay? So that's an important factor in what happened here. We know that there were Christians in the households, okay, servants, slaves, extended family of emperors from the middle of the mid to late first century. We know that there are Christians around Nero in the 60s who are members of his household. And most emperors over the next two centuries had one or more Christians who were either members of their families or who were working in prominent positions in their households. And so Paul, when he is imprisoned in Rome at the end of Acts, when he is under house arrest, it says that he had influence, among other things, with members of the Praetorian Guard who were responsible to protect the emperor and who were the people that were holding Paul, and with members through them, with some members of the extended group of people around the Roman emperor. And so Christianity makes an early impact on the most senior people in the empire. But this is a tremendous part of the story of the early church. Once you get over 50% of the empire in 350, it becomes more difficult to find people to convert. Okay? Evangelism slows down at some point because it's harder to find people to evangelize, right? When you are 0.07% of the population, it's easy to find people to evangelize. Almost anybody that you bump into is somebody that you might evangelize, because nobody that you run into through the course of the day is likely to be a believer. You know, one out of every 1,000 people, less than that, is a Christian at that time. So we see this is not growth, by the way, that requires mass conversions. This is not growth that requires a constant drumbeat of, you know, thousands of people are converted in a day or in a moment. This is 3.42% per year. And this is what this looks like. So this, something like this is what happened. The numbers in 40, 50, 100 are probably higher than Stark's numbers here. Stark's numbers are probably too low. They're probably too conservative. Okay, but the number in 300 is not too high. Both Christian and pagan sources around the beginning of the 4th century estimate that Christians were at least 10% of the population of the empire. And Constantine is converted partly because information about Christianity has been become common enough that he is aware. So we don't know exactly how he was evangelized, but knowledge about Christianity had become pretty common by that point. You got to be over 10% of the population for people to pay attention. So, but this is the dynamic that happened. When you are sitting in the year 100 or 150, is it pretty easy to see that, oh yeah, this will definitely happen. When a century on from the resurrection, more than a century on from the resurrection, you are less than 0.1% of the population, how confident are you that this evangelistic project is succeeding? And yet, it was. It's hard for us to see the significance of things that are occurring in front of us, but this project of bringing the gospel to the whole Roman Empire, and you know, we tend to focus on the Roman Empire because we know so much about the church in the West. And I'm going to spend some time here in a few weeks talking about the growth of the church in the East, but there's a lot less specific information, numerical stuff. But this is a pretty good study. So, and this is sociology, not evangelistic theory or something, but this is likely pretty much what happened. So one of the big questions that we face is why? Why did this happen? Why did the church grow in this way? We have an evangelistic responsibility today. What is it that we should learn? So let's go back a slide. And so these are the themes that I want to touch on that I think are key to understanding that growth. And the first thing is relationships. Conversions happen almost exclusively through relational networks. People are converted because they're in relationship with other people that believe the thing that they're being converted to. This is true for almost any kind of religious experience. If you're going to become a Jehovah's Witness, it's not going to happen unless you know Jehovah's Witnesses. And you have relationship with those people. If you don't have any relationships with Jehovah's Witnesses, you're not going to become one unless you have no relationships with basically anybody else. Street corner evangelism works only when you talk to people who are disconnected from any relational network. Orphans, widows, people that have just moved to town. People that are flying alone. People are much more likely to come to the faith when they have friends and family who are already in the church. Conversions tend to spread primarily based on friendships and family connections. People have more connections in the church than out of the church are very likely to be converted. People have a lot more connections outside the church than they do inside the church are relatively unlikely to be converted. This is true down through the ages. People in the church who have no connections with unbelievers, no significant connections with unbelievers, no significant relationships with unbelievers, are very unlikely to make any converts. It's as true today as it was in the second century. So, the early church was very good at being connected to people outside the church. Very good at building relationships with people that were unbelievers and getting into their lives. in ways that led to people being converted. People that don't have family connections and relational networks in the place that they are, for whatever reason, are much more open to evangelism and much more likely to be converted. Widows and orphans, people who are new in the city. One of the fundamental things that we see from the very early church, from Acts chapter 6 on, is there's a focus on service to widows and orphans, who are people that have no relational network to rely upon. And so service to those people kept those people alive. It invested in their lives. It was a good thing to do, but it was also a very powerful evangelistic tool. And new people in cities in the Roman era, people went to cities because cities were places where there was jobs and money to be made and opportunity. You know, even then, people didn't want to stay down on the farm. But when people came to cities, they were fundamentally disconnected from relationships to the family and friends, people that they'd grown up around. They were no longer, you know, when you left the small village, the small town, and went to the big city in the Roman era, you weren't communicating almost anything with the family and friends that you left behind. There was very little means to do so. If you wanted to write a letter, you had to get someone to deliver it. So if you knew somebody who was going that way and who would carry a letter for you, you could send a letter. But communicating was very difficult once you left the geographic area where your family and friends were. So new people in cities were disconnected and were looking for ways to connect with some people. And the church became a key place where Christians knew, if I went to a different city, there's a place for me to connect, and I will bring the people that I befriended along the way. I will tell them, when we get to the city, I know some people, and we can stay with them for a while. And it'll be safe. They won't rob us. They will help us. And I have never even met them before. But I know they will do this, because they're my brothers and sisters. And so, you know, people who are deeply committed to some faith don't convert to another, almost ever. But people who are casually committed to a faith, those people convert to something else a lot. And so people that have no depth, no foundation in whatever it is they believe, the inactive, the discontented, the people who are around the fringe, the people who see themselves as connected but never actually involve themselves in any of the activity or do things, those are people that can be converted to something else. Many pagans in the second century through the patristic era were people who were ripe for conversion because they were on the fringe. Pagan groups did not create commitment. And for the most part, they didn't ask for commitment. They just tried to drum up something where you'd show up from time to time and spend some money. But they didn't ask for any ongoing commitment. And so pagan people that were associated with pagan groups were relatively easy to convert because the thing that they were doing was not a thing that they were really deeply embedded in. So these things are true across eras and help us to understand, you know, how does the church come to grow today? It grows through relationships. If you don't have relationships with unbelievers, you are not going to make many converts. You would just not. You know, when you think of the people that have come to the faith in the last few years here, they are people that have been surrounded by Christians. You know, our friend Randy Romano was converted through the basketball ministry here, but he was converted through the basketball ministry here because the guys on the basketball court became core friends in his life, and his sister was already a believer, and she and her friends were praying for him. By the time he was converted to the faith, he was almost surrounded, right? And that's the way conversion has really been happening for most people for 2 millennia. I became a Christian because I went 3,000 miles from home in a time when there was no email and communication wasn't all that big, and I became associated with a group of people who cared for me, despite the fact that I was far, far away from where I'd been. That's how I became a Christian. So relational networks were key then, they're key today. A second big point here is the church has been majority female from sometime in the late first century down through the ages. Now, important, I keep emphasizing the point, but women are important and respected in the New Testament. You know, you sometimes hear different things about that, that the church has not respected women or whatever, but in the New Testament era, you know, we see Mary, the mother of Jesus, and all the other Marys, Priscilla, who is partnered with her husband in ministry that Paul has great respect for. And Paul says that Priscilla saved my neck. He doesn't explain that. Phoebe, who's the deaconess, Lydia, who is the first convert of the church at Philippi and hosts it in her home. Junia, who with her husband Andronicus is part of the ministry at the church in Rome. In Romans 16, Paul mentions by name, thanks, 18 men and 15 women. Considering that Paul spent a good bit of his time on the road and traveled only with men and was an unmarried man, it's amazing that Paul had relationships with that many women, that he had that many connections with women. That indicates that the church at Rome was probably majority female already. So Christian respect for women, inclusion of women, was super countercultural in the first century. Christians are the only significant group in the first century, in the latter part of the first century, that did not treat women as property. Okay? In Greek culture, women were property. In Roman, under Roman law, women were property. Okay? Christians did not see women in that way. Women had far higher status in the church than they did in either Roman society or Greek culture. Plus, you know, as we saw when we looked at Didache, and as we if we've looked at the writings of the first century church, the church from the late first century on was publicly and very directly opposed to abortion and infanticide, and that meant that women were a lot more common in Christian households than they were in pagan households of that day. Women were far less than half of all pagan Roman children. So in this era, the Roman Empire, there were something between 130 and 140 men for every 100 women, and maybe more. This is a really distorted sex ratio. You don't get there unless you are doing something to remove an awful lot of women from your society. Abortion rates for females, for babies that were suspected of being female, were high. Infanticide against female babies was endemic across the empire. And most female babies ended up dead. Children did not, or Romans, across the Roman Empire, female children were not valued and were mostly exposed, as they said. That is, they left them outside to die or to be taken or something. So there is an excavation. It was done here a few decades back of a Roman city that unearthed a very primitive kind of a sewer system and found that the sewer system was clogged. It was clogged with the bones of infants, hundreds of them, who had been dumped in the sewer. Probably almost all girls, or boys who were suspected of being in some way defective. The Roman writer Dio Cassius, writing around AD 200, complained that there were so few women in the Roman Empire that the population was shrinking. That's not made up. By AD 200, the Roman population, the population of the empire, the birth rate was so low that they were not at replacement level. Like Japan today. More people are dying than babies are being born. Okay. And in Japan today, by the way, people have lost interest in getting married, having children. Lots of people in their 30s have no children or unmarried and seem totally uninterested in any of these things. So, population is shrinking. The economy, serious problems. Okay. But the Roman Empire was facing this in the second century. A study of 600 families around Delphi in Greece in this period found that of those 600 families, there was only one that had more than one daughter out of 600 families. That's not random. That's infanticide on a mass scale. So Christians, by valuing girls, by believing that girls were a blessing from the Lord, were incredibly countercultural. A Roman husband, writing from Alexandria to his pregnant wife back in Rome, actually wrote to her, and this is a straight-up direct quote, "If it is a boy, keep it. If a girl, discard it." That's not a one-off. That's culture of the day. So when women are in short supply, and they were, they're going to be treated as property. Christianity, meanwhile, had a message that said God cares about women as individuals. He values women as individuals. The church valued and honored women and gave them roles that mattered and treated women as partners in the gospel. That is totally countercultural to anything else that was going on in that era. So as a result, women became a major part of the church from very early on. Now, women are consistently considered down through the ages to be more open to spiritual conversation, more open to spiritual interaction. That's true, as true today as it was then. The Emperor Valentinian, in AD 370 prohibited the evangelization of pagan women because so many women were being converted to the faith. He made a law against it. And the high numbers of women in the church meant that many women in the church were married to pagans, to unbelievers. Hence, Paul writes to the Corinthians about being unequally yoked. What does this mean? How shall you then live? Because many women in the church were married to unbelieving men. So there was a need to address these unions. And women are more generally attuned to relational networks. I know this is certainly true in my household, but it is generally true and not just specifically true. And relational networks are the means of growth. connections, connecting to people. So there's also an influence here, you know, the Acts of Thecla, we talked about that. But the popularity of that fostered the sense that women mattered greatly in the execution of the ministry, that ministry by women was legitimate and potentially important, that marriage was actually optional and could be set aside for strong spiritual reasons. You know, this became a step towards some kind of organized celibacy on the Christian side. But there's none of that in the early second century. In the early second century, Christians are known as people that have children. They're those weird people that have children and have a bunch of children in many cases. And it seemed to actually kind of like their children, which was really countercultural. Seemed to enjoy having children and think that it's a blessing of some sort. Very countercultural ideas at the time. So these are really important factors in the growth of the church in this era. And if you're thinking about trying to understand growth of the church over the patristic era, you've got to understand the giant impact of the interest that women had in Christianity because of the way that Christianity treated women and thought about women, and how very countercultural that was. In the last half century, you know, the Chinese government imposed these rules about, you know, one-child policy kinds of things. China has really distorted sex ratios today. 115, 120 men per 100 women in an age group. That is destabilizing. China's relationship with Burma is problematic going back a couple of decades because there are Chinese armed gangs that go into Burma and kidnap women on a regular basis and then sell them to Chinese men as wives because Chinese men can't find Chinese wives. And so this also means that in more rural parts of China, girls who are approaching marriageable age are regarded as a valuable bargaining chip and tend to get married off by their families in exchange for some favor when they're pretty young. In the Roman era, Roman law allowed girls to marry at age 12 and didn't enforce any prohibition on earlier marriage than that. Because there were so few girls growing up relative to the younger number of young men, many Roman girls were married by the time they were 12. Because there were so few of them around, you had to grab one when you could find one. And as a result, the fathers treated a girl as a relatively valuable piece of property and almost always traded her for something that was useful to him. Money, status, something. And so much of the abuse of women in the era was a result of those factors. Families and households are really important here too. This is an era where people in a family, in a household, believe that the head of the household is a figure that I have a responsibility to follow, to emulate. The strength of people's sense that I have a communal responsibility to my family was much higher than it is today in the society that we live in. And so people were highly influenced by what the head of the household did. And family loyalties were paramount for an awful lot of people. So Cornelius the centurion is converted to the faith, and what happens to his whole household? They all convert to the faith too. Now, That's partly because of Peter's preaching. It's partly because of the work of the Holy Spirit. But it has a whole lot to do with the fact that they're members of Cornelius' household. And when Cornelius does something, they do what Cornelius does. Because that's the way it works. Philippian jailer is converted to the faith. And his household, all of them too. Right? Same dynamic. And so these are not uncommon things. These are reflections of the power of the culture. The Emperor Commodus, who succeeded Marcus Aurelius in the second century, he had a concubine named Marcia, who was a believer. And one of the things that Marcia got Commodus to do was there's a guy named Callistus who was a believer who had been sentenced to work in the mines until he died, and Marcia got Commodus to release Callistus. Callistus went on to become the Bishop of Rome. So families and household connections matter a lot. And many of the men who came into the church from the second through the sixth centuries came into the church because their wives did first. And they weren't connected to anything in particular. And if you're not connected to anything in particular and you're married to somebody who is connected to something in a deep way, you are much more likely to become part of that thing that they do. And so men came into the churches in many cases because their wives were there first. And when that was the case, the rest of the household often followed. And so women came to the faith in large numbers. They influenced their husbands and those men. That led to the conversion of many households. Mike?
So a lot of what you've been talking about has been sociological and psychological aspects of growing the church visible, right? Mm-hmm. Is there anything that you can talk about in terms of growth of the church invisible during this time and how God was moving?
So we tend to think of this, and I wanted to emphasize those things because it's not just the fact that the Holy Spirit is at work. There's a lot of people dynamic that's going on here. There's a lot of reasons why it happened in this way. But the Spirit is at work. God is building his kingdom, right? And so we continually see that. And so we see that in the way that God is working through relationships, the kinds of relationships that he's putting people in, the connections that he is giving people, the places that he's putting people. New people coming into the city who connect with Christians, and those Christians help them out, are much more likely to become Christians. And the fact that Christians tended to serve and help new people in town, nobody else did that. The fact that Christians served widows and orphans, nobody else did that. The pagans taught that mercy was weakness, that it was evil, and practicing mercy showed that you were a bad person. Christians actively were merciful towards people in need. And that drew people into the church in significant ways. When we fail to love others, to serve the community, we can expect that relatively few people are going to come in the door. Our investment in the clothing closet is service to this community. It's service to those in need. It's something that nobody else is doing. That's what we picked doing. And it's something that draws people here every single week that we can build relationships with. If people come into the clothing closet and they just get some clothes and go out, it has no impact. It's only when we get those people to sit down and have a cup of tea and talk and build relationship with them that we're going to see conversions. That's the way it works. That's how God gets in to people's lives. It's by us investing in the relationship. So there are two great plagues One in the second century, one in the third century. And one of the things that the great plagues did was show that paganism had no answers for disaster, no answers for suffering, no answers for difficult times. Pagan organizations had no way to respond to the great plagues. And that was a catastrophe for pagans, and it was an opportunity for Christians. And persecutions, Christianity had a cost from early on. So people that were not serious didn't stick around. The church was fairly regularly purged of fringe people because it was risky, and so they walked away. And so high commitment draws potential converts. If the thing you're doing doesn't have any cost, why would anyone bother? If it's high cost, people will wonder why you pay the price, why you would do a hard thing. But if it doesn't cost you anything, why would they bother? If you're not paying any price for it, why should they bestir themselves to get up on Sunday morning and show up? Ray.
Gene, I appreciate the role of the church in partnering in evangelism and the importance of relationships. In Romans chapter 15, verse 20, Paul wrote this, "And thus I make it my ambition to preach the gospel, not where Christ has been already named, lest I build on someone else's foundation, but as is written, those who have not heard of him will see, and those who have never heard will understand," which would seem to be an apostolic encouragement to also especially be outside the church.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Paul, you know, the implications of what Paul is saying there are first of all, go to places where Christians aren't. Go to places where people have not yet been exposed to the faith. And so this is a huge driver for missions around the world. But it should also cause us to think, what are the places in our society where there aren't Christians? And how can we go to those places so that people there will hear the gospel and be exposed? So because there are people that are feeling cut off and lost and alone everywhere, and people like that are people that are ready to hear the gospel. So these are key factors in thinking about the growth of the church. So next slide, back to these numbers. Those are some of the fundamental factors that it's important to keep in mind when you look at these numbers and when you think about the growth of the church across this era, is that this is happening by relational networks, and it's happening because Christians are connected to a lot of unbelievers, and in many cases, unbelievers find that most of the people that they're connected with are believers. And such people get converted at very high rates. And Christians build a reputation as people who practice mercy, who care about other people, who are willing to sacrifice themselves to some degree for the sake of others. This attracts people who are in need and attracts and builds commitment in them. The church spread very strongly, primarily through women, but through family networks as a result of that. And those dynamics are still true today. So Constantine's mother is a huge factor here.
Right.
And she's a Christian long before he is, and she's a major influence. This is not an era where adult males tend to listen to mom very much, okay? That's not a cultural factor that's very apparent at the time, much more so today. But Constantine's mother is a hugely serious Christian.
Right.
You know, she travels across the Near East, seeking to go to the places that all these New Testament things happen. She comes back with the bones of saints and relics and, you know, and who knows specifically about how she obtained these things, but she went as the Dowager Empress, she went with money and servants and people. So she had resources to find stuff. But so she was an influence, and her prayers matter, right? So Constantine isn't converted, you know, as a man alone, but there are relationships around him where there are already Christians that are important in his life, and it's not just his mom.
Right. And so when you look from the 10% to the 56.5% in just a gap of 50 years, what I felt always was it was Constantine being the head of the empire, saying, this is my faith, and that encouraged the people in general to adopt that same kind of faith.
Yeah.
And it was safer at that point to do so.
Yeah, so once the emperor is converted, suddenly it becomes safe to become a Christian, and it becomes politically, potentially a little bit valuable to become a Christian, right? And so, you know, there's times when I wondered if Constantine's conversion wasn't a very bad thing for the church because it brought a lot of potentially unserious people into the church. But I want to point something out to you, and not to go all math guy on you because I'm totally not a math guy. But when you look at the 10.5% to 56.5%, that's the same rate of increase. Okay? The rate of increase is the same across this whole chart. 3.42% per year. It's just that once you get past 10%, 3.42%, you've got a lot of people. Once you get 6 million Christians, a rate of 3.42% makes a big deal. A lot more than it did when there were 7,500 Christians. So, but that's the same rate. It's not that the rate hasn't changed. The numbers are going up, but the rate is the same. And so it's likely that once Constantine was converted, that people came to the church at a higher rate, that caused some inflection, and so that the numbers in 350 actually ought to be a little higher because of that. But this is just mathematical. Okay? This isn't based on census information. This is based on what's the mathematical rate that gets you to about these numbers, which seem about right based on the other stuff that we've got. But once you get a lot of Christians, as long as those people still have contact with a lot of non-Christians, your rate of growth is going to be very high. I mean, the numerical growth will be very high, even if the rate just stays the same.